President Zelensky visits Saudi Arabia on his way to Japan.
Dear participants of the summit, today is the 450th day of the full-scale war waged against us by Russian invaders.
Plus, an anti-corruption breakthrough in Ukraine.
What's important in this story is that this is the highest position judge in Ukraine. This is the first ever precedent of such top judicial official to be arrested.
And later in the program, decades after the expulsion of Crimean Tatars from their homeland by Joseph Stalin, some still yearn to go home. Today is Friday, May 19th. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Leaders of the G7 nations are gathering in Hiroshima, Japan on Friday. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to join them on Sunday. Charles de Ledesma has the story.
G7 leaders say in a statement released after closed-door meetings, our support for Ukraine will not waver, vowing to stand together against Russia's illegal, unjustifiable, and unprovoked war of aggression against Ukraine. The united position continues, Russia started this war and can end the war. Leaders of the world's most powerful democracy have vowed to tighten punishments on Russia for its 15-month invasion of Ukraine, days before President Volodymyr Zelensky joins the Group of Seven summit in person on Sunday. A US official who spoke on condition of anonymity to preview the announcement says the Biden administration's component would blacklist about 70 Russian and third country entities involved in Russia's defense production and sanction more than 300 individuals, entities, aircraft and vessels. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
China is also on the agenda at the G7 summit. On Friday, the Chinese again reiterated their criticism of the West for supplying Ukraine with weapons. The Chinese claimed at the United Nations Security Council that they do not supply either party in the war and that they're neutral as they try to broker a peace deal. However, they have refused to condemn Moscow for the unprovoked invasion of its neighbor. As we've heard, President Zelensky is headed to the G7 summit in Hiroshima, where he'll join other world leaders to discuss his country's ongoing fight against the Russian invasion. On his way to Japan, Zelensky made a stop in Saudi Arabia to meet with Arab leaders at the Arab League summit in Jeddah, where he urged the other countries to support his peace initiative for ending Russia's war in Ukraine.
Thank you. At first, I express my gratitude for the warm hospitality to His Royal Highness Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, to the entire people of Saudi Arabia and the city of Jeddah, which is hosting this meeting. I hope that most of us are here for the sake of peace and justice. Dear participants of the summit, today is the 450th day of the full-scale war waged against us by Russian invaders.
It's Zelensky's first trip as president to Saudi Arabia. He said in his address that delegates would each receive the text of a 10-point peace plan, and he asked them to work with Ukraine directly without intermediaries. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman told the summit that his kingdom was ready to mediate between Russia and Ukraine. VOA's White House bureau chief, Patsy Wiedekuswara, is traveling with President Biden in Hiroshima for the G7 summit. She tells us to expect more sanctions placed on Russia and a crackdown on those helping it to evade them, all aimed at hampering Moscow's ability to fund its war in Ukraine.
President Joe Biden and other G7 leaders arrive in Hiroshima, Japan, armed with new sanctions targeting Moscow's ability to fund its war in Ukraine. In a meeting with summit host Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, Biden said the group stands for shared values,
including supporting brave people of Ukraine as they defend their sovereign territory, and holding Russia accountable for its new aggression, to ensuring a free and open Indo-Pacific.
Most of the sanctions are imposed by the U.S. on more than $58 billion worth of Russian assets. Kimberly Donovan is director of the Economic Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomic Center. She spoke to VOA on Zoom.
While last year was maybe the year of sanctions, I think this year is the year of enforcement of those sanctions, as well as looking at what additional export controls could be put in place to ensure that Russia is not able to get the military capability and technology it needs to conduct its war.
However, the group will not announce a comprehensive ban on goods exported to Russia. The summit will also focus on countering what the group calls China's economic coercion, trade practices for political goals. Summit host, Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida.
At the summit, I would like to demonstrate the unwavering determination of the G7 to uphold the free and open international order based on the rule of law.
As the summit opens on Friday, leaders are visiting the only structure still standing after the U.S. 1945 bombing of the city, now a memorial to peace. Patsy Wirakuswara, VOA News, Hiroshima, Japan.
And while in Hiroshima, Patsy Wirakuswara had the opportunity to sit down with John Kirby, spokesperson for the National Security Council. She asked him if the G7 summit would address military cooperation between Russia and Iran.
So administration officials have said that Iran is expanding its military cooperation with Russia. It has provided hundreds of drones for Ukraine to help Moscow on its war in Ukraine. Do you expect that the G7 leaders will particularly address this issue?
There is no question that the G7 leaders will talk about the ongoing war in Ukraine. In fact, there's a session this afternoon on Ukraine as well.
Specifically on Iran's
They
role.
Will talk about the full scope of the challenges inside the war in Ukraine. I can't speak specifically about what Iran is doing to support Russia or what Russia is doing reciprocally to support Iran in the region. But it is not an issue that is alien to, certainly not to us and not to any of the G7 leaders. And it's certainly possible that that could come up as a part of the discussions that they're going to be having on Ukraine. Let's not lose the big picture here. This is a burgeoning and improving defense relationship that is not only not good for the people of Ukraine, who have suffered enough, more than enough, but it's going to be not good for our friends and partners and neighbors in the Middle East region, as Iran tries to benefit from this relationship with Russia to improve their own military capabilities so that they can sow more discontent conduct more destabilizing activity in the region. So we're watching this very, very closely, and you're right. We have called it out publicly, and we'll continue to do so.
That's National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby speaking with VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wirakuswara. Diamonds might be beautiful, but it seems they also might be causing some geopolitical tension. At the G7 summit, leaders will discuss how to limit Russian diamond exports in an effort to further punish Russia for the war in Ukraine. Julian Satterthwaite has the story.
G7 leaders gathering in Japan for a weekend summit have a new round of Russian sanctions in mind. The country's lucrative metals exports could be one target. Diamonds could be another. A G7 official said there wouldn't be a deal this weekend, but diamonds would be in the final summit communique. The idea of restricting the trade was floated by Poland in April, but any such move could be derailed by a complex debate within the EU. Belgium, home to the world's biggest diamond trading hub in Antwerp, is against a ban. Other G7 nations are concerned that sanctions could just see the trade funneled through countries like India instead. Two sources in the group said the idea was to develop tracing technologies that would prevent that, but that could take time. Even so, European Council President Charles Michel says the EU will impose restrictions. Britain doesn't want to wait either. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is set to announce a ban on Russian diamonds and metals including copper and nickel. New measures will also target more individuals involved in the energy, metals and shipping trades. Pressure for more action may ramp up over the weekend when Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky is expected to fly into the Hiroshima summit. An official in Kyiv said it was essential he go there to defend the country's interests.
That was Julian Satterthwaite of Reuters reporting. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. Time now to check in with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. We'll get the latest on a major anti-corruption case in Ukraine. But first, more details about President Zelensky's travels and his visit to the Arab League summit in Saudi Arabia.
President Zelensky informed his colleagues regarding the security situation in Ukraine and about the war with Russia, which is ongoing, about the latest updates and situation. Also, what was discussed is the main element of the Ukrainian peace formula, and probably we will get some additional information, some more information, additional information later on. What President Zelensky also highlighted that he also noted the successful participation of Saudi Arabia in the return of 10 foreign prisoners of war from Russian captivity. It happened months ago, and we remember it was also confirmation of the involvement of Saudi Arabia part. So this is kind of something that we have for now. And we know that President Zelensky, after this summit, he's going to Japan for a G7 meeting.
So when Zelensky meets with foreign leaders, and he's met with them individually, either in Europe, here in the United States, they've gone to see him in Kyiv. He talks about security, about Ukraine's need for more weapons, for more air defense, for jets, for tanks, whatever the subject is. How is the G7 going to be any different, or is it pretty much going to be the same conversation all over again?
I think that here it's important, first of all, it's important that this is the first physical participation of President Zelensky in such kind of event, because he was invited previously as well, but we know that he participated online due to the fact that he was not able to leave the country at that moment, and now he's heading there physically, and of course it's important, and it creates additional credibility, you know, for such event, for such activity, let's put it this way. And of course, meeting with everyone at once in one place, it's an additional positive moment and important moment for Ukraine and for the president. So I think that this is the reason, these two reasons are probably the main ones why this is such an important trip. And of course, for Ukrainians, if we talk about the society, from the inside of the country, it's also quite quite fascinating to see president of the country being a part of such top level events and being and standing next to the leaders of the world.
Now, Anna, something else has been going on in Kyiv, and we haven't yet spoken about it. Details have been hard to come by, but I think there is enough public knowledge now that we can discuss it. A big development in Ukraine's anti-corruption investigations and anti-corruption push. Can you tell us the latest?
Yes, actually, now we can say that it was quite a huge arrest happening a couple of days ago. The head of the Supreme Court of Ukraine was arrested because of the alleged bribe, and the amount of this bribe is almost $3 million. So for the moment, we know that the judge is under the arrest. He is not. The members of Supreme Court voted him out of the position, of course, and for the moment, for the moment, the investigation isn't going, so we do not really get a lot of details. What's important in this story is that this is the highest position judge in Ukraine. This is the first ever precedent of such top judicial official to be arrested and to be caught on such with such bribe. So for Ukraine and for the reforms that Ukraine is going through, and this reform is a part of Ukrainian euro integration reforms and euro integration pass, this is an extremely important event.
Certainly a story we'll be following in the days and weeks to come. Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. Anna, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Ukraine's deputy defense minister on Thursday said Kyiv's forces had repelled day-long Russian attacks in Bakhmut, as both Kyiv and the Wagner mercenary group reported further Russian retreats around the embattled eastern city. Reuters' Emma Gell reports.
The Ukrainian military on Thursday released footage purporting to show its forces attacking and destroying Russian units near the eastern city of Bakhmut. Reuters has been unable to confirm the location or the date of the video, which was posted to social media by Ukraine's top commander. Both Kyiv and a Russian mercenary group reported further Russian retreats around the city. Kyiv says it has launched local advances as a prelude to an upcoming big counteroffensive that it hopes will turn the tide against Russia's 15-month-old invasion. Ukraine's military said troops had advanced in places by more than a mile, and Ukraine's deputy defense minister said that day-long Russian attacks in the city had been repelled. However, the commander of the Wagner paramilitary group leading the Russian assault on Bakhmut claimed his forces were still advancing on Thursday. But Yevgeny Prigozhin accused commanders of Russia's regular forces of abandoning ground north and south of the city, raising the risk of troops inside being encircled. Near the front line, Ukrainian troops said Russia was bombarding access roads to slow the advances, which has shifted the momentum after months of slow Russian gains. Andrei Kornyi commands an air defense division near the front line.
The shelling is ongoing. You can see for yourself that it seems to have calmed down a bit. But they are constantly working like this, constantly looking for something, somewhere. They are covering us with fire. Well, they work. It's obvious they're digging in, and they want to show us how strong they are.
The Russian Defense Ministry has acknowledged some withdrawals from positions near Bakhmut over the past week, but denied Prigozhin's assertions that flanks are crumbling.
That's Reuters' Emma Gell reporting. May 18th marked a painful anniversary for Crimea's Tatars, descendants of nearly 200,000 victims of mass deportation by Soviet authorities over a three-day period in 1944. And now their grandchildren are speaking with VOA reporter Lisa Bakalets in Warsaw about their hopes for the future.
Akhtem Seitablaev is a Crimean Tatar actor and film director. On the eve of the anniversary, he was in Warsaw once again showing his film Haytarma, which means return in the Crimean Tatar language. Seitablaev is able to tell the story in a deeply personal way.
Both dad and mom were deported. They were children then. And some memories, in particular of my mother, became episodes of the film Haytarma.
Akhtem says Soviet authorities didn't give people enough time to pack their belongings.
Our people are well aware of the phrase 15 minutes for gathering your stuff. What can a confused woman with five children do whose husband is at the front in the ranks of the Soviet army?
The activist Alim Aliyev has a similar story. His grandmother, Niyar, was 18 years old at the time.
2 days before the deportation, two NKVD officers came, as they explained, to take a population census. They recorded who lived, what property they had, and my great-grandmother even fed them soup with noodles. The same soldiers came 2 days later at night to deport my family.
More than 200,000 Crimean Tatars were deported from the Crimean Peninsula during the first 3 days from May 18, 1944, when Joseph Stalin issued the order. Historian Sergei Gromenko, who studies Crimean history, says the Soviets emptied the peninsula.
According to statistics, even Soviet ones, in the 1940s, there was only one Crimean Tatar on the territory of the Crimean Peninsula itself, all of the more than 230,000 people who lived there at the start of the war.
Soviet authorities officially explained the deportation as collective punishment for what they claimed was collaboration by some Crimean Tatars with Nazi Germany. The vast majority were sent to Uzbekistan.
These were people who had no official guilt. They were considered administratively punished. Those who were arrested during the deportation and accused of collaboration mostly went to Siberia.
It was only in 1989, as part of the period of reform and openness known as Perestroika, that the Soviets recognized the decision as illegal and Crimean Tatars were allowed to return home. Among those who returned was the family of the World Congress of Crimean Tatars member in Poland, Nedim Usainov.
The first thing my grandparents did, they sold our house in Uzbekistan. Mom quit her job. She had a high position at large state plant. They left all this without considering the consequences and returned to Crimea, to the great unknown, one can say.
Previously, every May 18th, Crimean Tatars gathered for a memorial rally in Simferopol. The last such event took place in 2013, before Russia annexed the peninsula. Neither Akhtem, Nedim, nor Alim were in Crimea. Their activities make it dangerous for them to return home for now. But all of them have relatives who refused to leave the peninsula. They say they lost the motherland once and will now wait in Crimea while Ukraine recovers it. Lesia Bakalets for VOA News, Warsaw.
The United Nations and Turkey have negotiated a two-month extension to an agreement allowing Ukrainian farmers to continue to export millions of tons of grain through the Black Sea to points around the world. That's good news for Dutch farmer Urkiz Huizinga, who's been farming in Ukraine for 20 years. Anna Kostachenko has the story.
Dutch farmer Kees Huizinga is 48, and for over two decades now his days have started at 6:30 in the morning, rain or shine. He moved to Ukraine 20 years ago and started a successful farming business in the Cherkasy region. Today his farm spreads over 15,000 hectares of land, and Huizinga maintains a herd of over 2,000 cows. Everything here runs on a very precise schedule.
The cows, they love, they need to have a regular schedule. I mean, every day, everything has to be the same. You know, when you start feeding them, the ration itself, so the mixture of the feed has to be the same every day.
When Russia invaded Ukraine, Huizinga stayed and still has no plans to leave. He refuses to abandon his business and over 350 employees who rely on him for their livelihoods.
I hate the Russians, you know. So if I flee the country, if I leave the business alone, then I'm not supporting Ukraine, I'm not supporting the army, I'm not supporting the soldiers. And then the Russians will come here. So we can't have the Russians here.
The Russian occupation and its attack in the Kherson region, Ukraine's primary vegetable producer, have resulted in food shortages, and prices for root vegetables have risen dramatically. Huizinga grows a variety of vegetables and grain crops that help offset shortages. On May 17, a deal to allow Ukraine to continue to export grain through the Black Sea was extended for 60 days after the United Nations and Turkey renegotiated the agreement with Russia. But the agreement allows Ukrainian shipments to avoid tariffs, and that has caused problems for some European farmers who say it's lowering the price of grain around the world and hurting domestic farmers. Some, including Poland and Hungary, have banned Ukrainian imports. Huizinga says all these issues are making it hard to do business during wartime.
The biggest problem is the insecurity. I mean, we don't know if we can sell what we grow here, you know, if the Black Sea ports will be open or not, if the road and train. So that's the insecurity. That's the biggest challenge or issue we have.
According to some estimates, over 20% of Ukrainian farmers are currently serving in the armed forces of Ukraine. Those who remained at their jobs are trying to pick up the slack, feed the country, and meet global demand. Anna Kostichenko for VOA News, Cherkasy region, Ukraine.
And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day. Visit us online at voanews.com and on social media. Be sure to follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish.
Thank you. This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.